Hi, Katie Marquette here. So just a quick note before we dive into this episode. First of all, if you are enjoying this podcast, please give it a rating on iTunes. I would absolutely love to hear your feedback. And I also want to give a shout out to another awesome spooky podcast. It's a show called Spirits. And if you like the noir and bizarre, I think you'll really love this show. It's a history and comedy podcast focused on folklore and mythology. Every week, historian and mythology buff Julia and her childhood best friend Amanda get together over drinks or spirits, touche ladies, and talk about everything from Wonder Woman to modern urban legends. To find out more, visit spiritspodcast.com or download Spirits wherever you get your podcasts. So without further ado, let's get going on this episode. Thanks again so much for your support and for tuning in.
You know how to whistle, don't you, Steve? You know how to whistle, don't you, Steve?
They're demons.
Experience the excitement, the danger.
But it would be slightly more difficult to pull off now, though, don't you think?
If there is one consistency throughout human history, it is this. The human mind does not know how to grapple with its own mortality. So whether you are a 21st century person listening to this podcast while checking social media on your phone, or a medieval peasant who's just lost yet another relative to the plague, you are going to have to deal with this reality someday. Nobody gets out of this thing alive. I was at the Walters Art Museum here in Baltimore recently. It's one of my favorite places, in part because of this little room called the Collector's Study. It has all kinds of weird stuff in it that you might find in a scholar's study throughout the centuries. And it's so fascinating to learn that it was common practice to have a human skull on your desk to remind you that you are going to die someday. Like, imagine that. Imagine your desk at work, you're sitting there, you're checking emails, and then you look to your left and you see a human skull. And it's there to remind you that, yes, that email that you're sending is important, but it's even more important that you realize that you're going to die someday. That is just wild to me. And in fact, memento mori objects were incredibly common. Long before goth kids started wearing skull rings, lords and ladies in the 15th century were wearing them to keep them humble and aware of their own mortality. People created elaborate skeleton statues to keep in their homes, just so they'd never forget this fundamental fact. Imagine seeing that on HGTV. Can you imagine Chip and Joanna Gaines putting in a skeleton statue next to some shiplap, just so you know your house is beautiful, but also remember you're not going to be here forever because you are going to die. This is the sort of stuff people used to do all the time. People who were rich and wealthy and living high-flying lifestyles. You know, this is not just for peasants. This is for people who had it all in this life. And they wanted to make sure that they never forgot that this was all temporary. I also noticed when I was in the Walters that the many paintings I saw of Mary Magdalene often show her holding a skull, sometimes hand in hand with a crucifix. The realities of death were never meant to be neutralized or forgotten, even by religious faith. In fact, religious faith was meant to make you even more aware of death. This is not the religion that Karl Marx was talking about, the opiate of the masses. This is a heavy, heavy idea of religion. It has you thinking about skulls and decay and blood and torture all day long. And in fact, that's what a lot of saints used to do. That was a common thing that you meditated on. The suffering of Christ, yes. And the redemptive qualities of that, yes. But also, ashes to ashes. The end of all things. So not all cherubs and angels and harps for these saints. They were thinking about the real thing. Death, the equalizer, the one thing we are all going to experience, the one thing that someone 6,000 years ago experienced and that you and I are definitely going to experience. This is so different than our modern understandings of death. I can't tell you how often I tell people I'm researching death and they become uncomfortable, or say something like, isn't that depressing or morbid? So how have we understood death throughout the centuries? How has that changed? What faces have we given to death? In our dreams, in our mythologies, and in our nightmares? On this episode, I'm talking with Joanna Ebenstein, a kindred spirit when it comes to an interest in portrayals and understandings of death. For a while, she was creator and curator of the Morbid Anatomy Museum in New York. Unfortunately, that's now closed, but she still has a Morbid Anatomy blog that you can find online. And she's an author and speaker on historical and classical topics, especially those related to our perceptions of death. I gave her a ring recently, and we had a really engrossing conversation. I hope you enjoy it. This whole project really stems from your own interest and fascination with our topic of the day, which is death. Can you just tell me a little bit about that? I mean, I think probably more little kids than you would think are really interested in death, but you really went all the way. You were really interested, and it sounds like you had a really supportive family that were not freaked out by this.
Yeah, I mean, my quick answer is I think all kids are interested in death. I think it's a culturally learned thing that we're not supposed to be interested in death. And so I feel like I am just very lucky in that, as you said, I had a supportive family that I just didn't get shamed into leaving that interest behind at a certain point.
Yeah, so what did that look like for you when you were a kid? How did that interest come out?
Yeah, so I guess for me as a kid, like, I loved animals. I wanted to be a wildlife photographer or a veterinarian when I was a little kid. And, you know, I would go door to door to try to get people to sign a petition. So the harp seal, the baby harp seals to get killed. I had pets of my own. I would save birds that I found that were hurt. I'd feed them. I'd care for them. I'd give them to the SPCA or whatever. And then also, it seems incongruous to some, but not to Morbid Anatomy people, I would also, if I found a dead baby bird, for example, or a sea urchin, I would put it in formaldehyde.
You know, that reminds me sort of like, you know, Teddy Roosevelt so famously did that.
Yeah.
He was such a, you know, now we think of him as such an advocate for nature and for animals, but he was really fascinated with sort of taxidermying animals he would find. So you're also an author of The Anatomical Venus, and I think more recently, Death, A Graveside Companion. Why don't you just tell us a little bit about those two books?
Yeah, so Death, A Graveside Companion is my most recent book, which is kind of probably the most fitting for what we're talking about today. I'm the editor, actually not the author, so it's a collection of essays. I think it's about 20 essays. And it's got over 1,000 images, basically looking at the ways in which humans have pictured what I consider one of the last great mysteries, if not the last great mystery, which is death. So what interests me, what has always interested me about death is not death in and of itself, but rather how humans make sense of it and how that changes over time and how much this is highlighted by the way that today we can't even talk about it in a straightforward way. We have all these euphemisms, you know, which just says so much. I'm very interested in the ways in which we project our imagination into this great unknown realm and create images that explain our feelings about this you know, rite of passage, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. And I'm also equally interested. And I also totally agree with you that we live in a society that just doesn't want to talk about death. But this is, as you've pointed out in your writings and talks, is not the norm. Could you give our listeners a little bit of an idea of just how sort of bizarre we would find some of what were very everyday practices for many, many centuries?
Well, exactly. And this is what really strikes me. So my background is history. I studied intellectual history at college. And what that is really about is looking at the cultural products of different time periods in order to understand the time period, but also to understand ourselves. So when I began, I've always been interested in death, but when I began to look at it through that lens, when I was a bit older, I began to really think about all of these images related to death. So I'll backtrack and I'll say I went to Europe for the first time right after university. And I saw all of these images relating to death that were so different than anything that I had ever seen in my life in California, which is where I grew up. And these were images that entwined death and beauty in ways that were completely unexpected, in ways that I had no previous understanding of. And I began to think, why does this look so strange to me? This is an intellectual history question. Why do all of these cultural products in the past just look utterly bizarre? And I think that's exactly what I find so interesting, is any cultural shift that has rendered basically all of the past to look morbid and bizarre says much more about us than it does about them. There's so much more commonality in the views that people used to have about death than what we are today. And I think, to me, there's just something really, really interesting to play with there. And so what I've always tried to do through Morbid Anatomy, through our exhibitions, through the blog, through the events that we do, is just show all of these different examples without saying what I'm saying to you right now, that I think the fact that we find it bizarre says more about us, not as a way to moralize or to teach, but just as a way to help people come to the same realization that I came to, just to think, You know, we call the 19th century death obsessed, or we call the 18th century death obsessed, or we call the medieval times death obsessed. But actually, if every other era we would consider death obsessed, then maybe there's something about us that makes us different. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I totally, totally agree. I also think that maybe there's like a craving for being reminded of death in our society. I always think it's so interesting in the Catholic Church that, you know, Ash Wednesday is not a holy day of obligation. We don't have to go to church, but the churches are always packed. And it's such a weird sort of ritual that, you know, people really want to stand in line and have a priest remind them they're going to die. And this is one of the most popular days of the year.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that as not a Catholic. I find that really interesting. I really, really, really believe. The other thing I would say is not only have people surrounded themselves with images of death, but death was also a topic of conversation. And it was encouraged in many, many, many practices cross-culturally around the world at different times to contemplate death on a regular basis as a way to a better life. And I think in a way, maybe because now we're so distant, we're so much more secular than we were ever as humans. That's the other, I think, really important element that I always think about when I think about why death is now so feared and maligned. I think we don't have a belief structure that makes sense of it anymore. Mm-hmm. And if we, you know, many of us in a purely secular world, so death is only evil in that context. There's a craving today. I think it's necessary to connect with the bigger themes of life. And I think death is one of them. It's not the only one, but it's one of them. And I think when people were religious and they went to church every week, you know, for better or for worse, they were connecting. They were stepping outside of the everyday and the mundane and connecting to larger kind of archetypal energies and ideas. And we don't have much of a way to do that anymore. And I think connecting to ideas is important in that way, but also just in the way that it is this great unknown that defines our lives in so many ways, right? It's like we don't know when we will die, but we know we will die, barring a medical miracle. So that said, that defines and explains and sets stage for how we choose to live our lives and the value of that, right?
Right. Yeah. Actually, this, you just sort of quoted one of my questions, which was that I'm really interested in sort of mystical traditions throughout all religions, but especially with the saints and things like that. And I was going to ask if a decline in religiosity was part of this, because if you don't believe in a soul, does the death of the body just become empty?
That's my belief. I mean, I've never read anyone writing about it, but when I look at all this stuff and I think about how much has changed, I think that's basically, I mean, there are a few major changes that happened. I would say, you know, my area of expertise in intellectual history was late 19th, early 20th century. Mm-hmm. And there are a bunch of changes there. This is the time when death becomes strange and other to us. And this includes, you know, increased sanitation and better health care, hand washing before surgery, you know, all of these things. You know, in the 19th century, for example, up to 3 out of 5 children died before reaching adulthood. You know, you would live with your extended families. It was not exotic because it could not be exotic, right? Mm-hmm. There was no way for it to be exotic until now. So we have all these changes. People didn't have hospitals then in the same way that they do now. So you have all these changes. But then, yeah, I think the more I look at it, and especially when I worked on the book Death, a Graveside Companion, and looked at all these images, they're overwhelmingly religious. And then they become scientific and pop culture. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what takes religion's place, I think.
Right.
Fulfilling, you know, our search for meaning. So I think popular culture is telling us stories that give life meaning. And then I think science is unfortunately, you know, not to diss on science, but a mythology. It's our belief system today that defines how we think about life and death, the same way religion used to. And I think, unfortunately for humans, it just doesn't offer a lot of emotional sustenance or a narrative that helps us in any way.
So before we start talking specifically about these personifications of death, could you just like describe maybe like 3 practices that people did surrounding death or after somebody died that we would find really weird today?
Yeah, one of them is postmortem photography. So in the 19th century, when a loved one died, you know, photography was still an expensive and pretty new process at this point. And often there would have been a picture of the person before they died. So you would pay a photographer to come take a picture of your dead loved one, be it a child or adult, posed often as if sleeping. and were kept at family keep. They were hung on the wall. They were made into lockets. They were kept in family albums, and this was not seen as morbid at all.
Yeah, you know, I have seen some photographers who are doing these sort of like angel photos with like Photoshop, where they're putting in, you know, maybe a deceased child or, you know, something like that, like will be sort of floating there next to the, you know, looking translucent, but is sort of being imposed into the photo.
I think it's interesting. And so another practice that we covered in that show was making objects with the hair of the dead. And we actually teach a class on this. So it's called Victorian hair art. And so basically, it wasn't always made with the hair of the dead. It could be made with family members. It's like a family tree made of hair. But, you know, it's a part of the body that lasts forever, like bone. But it's much more individualistic and personal. And people would make mourning scenes, like basically cemetery scenes, in which all of the elements, like the tree branches and the fences and things are made out of human hair. Or you might have a locket with human hair arranged in a beautiful fashion or things like this. And this was very popular in the 18th and 19th century. And the classes are really popular. And as a matter of fact, we have an exhibition of hair art right now up at the Mütter Museum. So it's jewelry, it's dioramas and shadow boxes. And it's really beautiful.
Wow. Yeah, that's, you know, I think that if you think about when people used to sort of take a locket of somebody's hair and would sort of keep mm-hmm. it, you know, around their neck, I think, you know, you think of like how, what was it, Angelina Jolie, right, had her vial of blood around her neck or something at some
point. I didn't know that.
Yeah, she had Billy Bob Thornton's blood around her neck at some point.
Oh,
so
wow.
She was
That's
really,
actually very cool.
Yeah. So I think, yeah, you're right, though. I mean, that is definitely very strange. I don't think people do that anymore. It's not an impulse
well,
to be like, I want to save my you know, my loved one's hair.
I don't think it is in the same way. Though I think now that people are aware of the practice, they are starting to do it. And I know from our teacher that people have gone to her to make contemporary hair work from people they lost. So it is now being a done thing again, now that people are discovering it again.
Hmm.
And then another thing that would be done were death masks. We had two of those in the show as well. So after someone died, especially someone who was notable as a celebrity or maybe a criminal, a cast to be made of their face. And this is actually how Madame Tussauds got started. It is said that she had to collect the beheaded bodies from the guillotine and basically make death masks from them, from which she then made wax models. So this is another tradition of commemorating and remembering the dead.
I've seen some. Doesn't Dante have a death mask?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dante has a death mask. Napoleon has a death mask.
Yeah. That's so wild.
Abraham Lincoln has a death mask. Yeah, and this was very popular.
Yeah.
And when you think about it, it's a really amazing kind of portraiture, too. It is a, and especially in a time when there were no photographs, right?
Yeah.
When you could get a real likeness of the loved one. And sometimes life masks were taken, too, to be fair. They weren't always on the dead, but often on the dead.
Well, sort of then it's like you remember. You're like, well, we better get a mask done now.
Right. You don't have much time.
This is it. So let's get into first. Have you ever seen the movie Meet Joe Black? Brad
no.
Pitt plays Death in this movie. So
it's
a really weird, sappy movie, but I really like it because it's so weird the story, it's actually based on an old, I think, movie from the 1930s called Death Takes a Holiday. And the idea is that, have you seen that?
I watched part of it.
So like the Meet Joe Black idea is that Death basically wants to figure out what this mortal thing is all about. So he basically kills off a guy, takes on Brad Pitt's body and follows Anthony Hopkins around to sort of see what a full life is about. So anyway, I saw that movie on TV like a few weeks ago. I had seen it many times before, but it sort of got me. That's actually what made me think about this idea for this episode. I was like, that is a personification of death. That's a modern personification mm-hmm. of death that we're dealing with. So it made me think about lots of other personifications of death. So I think the first one everyone thinks of is like the Grim Reaper, right? Where does this come from?
Yeah. And I was trying to do some reading on that today because I found a lack of clarity in this. Some people say that it begins with the Black Plague. It's certainly popularized around the time of the Black Plague. But there are a lot of people who say it's earlier. It's really hard to tell exactly when. But what it certainly became the big deal it is now around that time. When I think about this and this notion of the personification of death and why at a certain time in history that idea of looking at death in that way would become popular, literally as, you know, a skeletal form. I think when I think of the Black Plague, you know, it decimated, you know, by some estimates, a third of European population, and it hit indiscriminately. It seemed to hit indiscriminately. And I think this idea of a person, right, or a god or a goddess, is kind of capricious. You know, it's not good and evil. It's not punishment and reward. It's quirky. It's eccentric. It makes random decisions that you really can't predict. And that's kind of how I see the personification of death. When it comes like that, when it begins to be seen like that, I believe that it has to do with a death that is seemingly unpredictable and capricious. So I think that it comes in times of war and violence.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I hadn't thought about that, but that definitely seems to be true, that these images and these personifications come at times when death seems random. Like, there is no sense to this.
And no morality, you know? Like, it's not like there's also the gods and things, especially in the Christian religion, where, you know, punishment and things like this. It's not about punishment. It's not about good and bad. It's not about deserving or not deserving. It's like, nah, you, and maybe all of you.
Yeah, like, kind who knows, of,
you know,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that I never thought about this before, but, like, it's in the book of Job, you know, the most, senseless suffering, and God appears as a whirlwind, as sort of chaos.
So, you know, the concept of the psychopomp, which is a figure that basically takes the souls of the dead, souls of the dead from the land of the living to the dead.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an idea that comes up again and again in these angels of death and these other figures that were.
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of in the Abrahamic traditions, the angel Azrael is the angel of death, and sort of we have the idea of Michael the archangel serves a similar role as sort of this angel that sort of accompanies a soul on their way to the afterlife, which of course I think is probably most famous in Greek mythology, meeting, now I'm blanking on his name, meeting him
Charon?
On the river. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, on the river Styx.
The river Styx, and getting paying your tokens and making sure that have enough money to get across. And I think while we're sort of touching on Greek, I was really interested in Thanatos, mostly because he's the brother of Hypnos, the god of sleep. And I'm really sort of interested, you know, especially like you said earlier, that portraits would be taken of people after they died, you know, as if they were asleep, and sort of the idea of death as sleep and this sort of relationship that, you know, that death is the brother of sleep.
Yeah, I find it really interesting, too. And also the son of night, which I really, really love. I guess, and that kind of traces to, like, later, like, 19th century Christian ideas of, like, eternal sleep and things like this, right? But I guess, death and sleep do have a lot in common. You close your eyes. There's a lot of, like, physical, visual similarities there that I think make sense. But I think some of Thanatos' other siblings were, like, doom and chaos and some other things, too. So there's some less...
Yeah,
there's some less nice, but I think he's closest brother to his own.
Yes.
And they were often depicted together. It is really interesting.
I think also sleep ties in, you know, of course, the sort of physical repose, but also the idea of the unconscious, and that our dreams and, you know, where we end up when we sleep is sort of out of our control. I'm sure as a Jungian, you have ideas about the importance of that, but... I like that idea too, of sort of that sleep is also the area of the unknown that we get to experience on hopefully a daily basis.
And I would also say the other link between those two things is traditionally dreams are seen as a place where the invisible world met our world. So it's seen as a place where spirits would communicate to us and we would kind of interact with kind of the mysteries beyond our comprehension, and death is seen as the other place. So I think they have that in common. It's like... those are the places maybe where the boundaries between whatever we want to call the divine realm or the realm outside of ourselves, the mysterious other realm and ourselves kind of collapse.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's where the ego dies, right? I mean, you can't control it anymore. So Yeah, and I think a lot of these other ideas of death, these personifications, were often sort of people would see them in their dreams, that if you saw a vision of one of these personifications, that meant that death was coming, so that they would greet them in dreams. There was one I had never heard of. I'm not going to be able to pronounce this because I don't know Gaelic.
I know it is because I had to look up the pronunciation myself. Yeah, like, Benia.
Okay. So it's Scottish.
Benia.
Benia. Okay.
Yeah.
Gaelic is such a beautiful language. I wish I could pronounce it all. But so it's Scottish Gaelic for washerwoman or laundress. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I just thought this image of this woman sort of washing bloody rags in lonely streams was very riveting to me.
It was beautiful. I have to say, until I got your email, I had not heard of that before. I'd heard of banshees, but not Bania. It is a really beautiful and strange myth. And did they not say also that basically Bania, they were female figures, and they were seen as women who had died in childbirth, and that's what the blood had to do with as well, although they were washing the blood, from what I understand, of the person who was going to die. So they were harbingers of death. If you saw one, then it was an indication that you were going to die.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I read sort of, I think like a lot of these ideas, there were lots of different stories about who they were and why they were there. But that was definitely mm-hmm. one of them, was that, especially if there were multiple of them, then they were seen to be women who had died in childbirth. And then there was also some sort of idea that if you properly washed someone's clothes, like before they died or after they died, they wouldn't show up or something. There was something about, you know, wash their clothes was very important.
Yeah. I read that too, that basically some people believe that they were stuck on Earth for the length of time that they would have lived if they hadn't died of childbirth. But if their clothes had been properly washed, they would not have been stuck on Earth.
Right, yeah. So
it sounds like kind of a not such a great experience for the Bania. It sounds like kind of
no.
cursed.
Yeah, right. Not such a great time. But and I also read, I don't know if this was true, I don't know if I only saw this in one source, but that Bania is a type of banshee.
Yes, it is. That's what I read too. It's a
okay,
type of banshee.
A type of banshee. And so a banshee, I think everybody, you know, I mean, everybody at least knows what a banshee sounds like.
yeah.
But sort of they're the women of the fairy mound. They're such so interesting.
Yeah, and I love, so the fact that they're still the professional keeners and whalers that you might bring to your funeral. This is still a tradition in Ireland, or so I was reading.
Yeah. And that's such an interesting idea, too, probably for another time, but that, you know, the rituals surrounding death have changed so much, but that, you know, the idea of a professional mourner and somebody who would literally come to wail, you know, and sort of give expression to those inexpressible feelings was the norm.
Yeah. And this goes back to ancient Greece, but also that the banshee, if you saw her, just like this Bania, who was a type of banshee, is a harbinger of death for someone in your family. So if you see her and hear her with her screaming and her wailing, then you know.
Right. And if you think about, if you've ever been to Ireland or Scotland, and you think about how that must have been like out being out on the moors and hearing that sort of whistling through the heather, you could imagine how sort of terrifying that would be.
Especially in the time, I mean, it's so silly to say, but before electric lights and,
it's very dark.
You know, like think of, how uncanny and how close to the natural world things were back then.
Yeah. I guess like I would just, the last thing I would ask you is, I think a lot of people, like we were saying in the beginning, I think people are naturally interested in death, and I think people are naturally intrigued and interested in myth and folklore and sort of these stories. I think we naturally are narrative makers, especially around these ideas. So what would you say, I guess, to people to sort of say that, you know, I think a lot of people, if I say, well, I'm researching death, they would think I had a really kind of a bummer of a day, but I actually would have had a great day. So, you know, like it doesn't have to be sad. What would you say to people about sort of how that incorporates into your life?
Funny, I have to have this conversation a lot, as you can imagine. Often when I'm being interviewed, someone will say, oh, you seem so happy, you know, and you have blonde hair, you're not gothy. Like, they just can't even understand, you know. And then I say, well, here's how I look at it, you know. People always called me morbid for being interested in death. And I used to say, okay, yeah, I guess I'm morbid. And then at some point I just started to think, well, you know, wait a second, why? You know, why is it morbid to think about death? If everyone who's ever lived is going to die, if I'm going to die, again, barring a medical miracle, then why do we see it as morbid to think about it or talk about it? And how screwed up I think that is. And I think, frankly, I think it's morbid not to think about death. I think it's like being a child. It's like refusing to acknowledge a fact of life. And rather than pretend it's not going to exist, I think it makes a whole lot more sense to think about it, contemplate it, come to terms with it, and maybe reduce your fear around it.
Well, I totally agree with you. And as a fellow blonde-haired woman who researches death, I... yeah, they're like, really? Like, you really like that stuff? I'm like, yeah, I really do.
But so. This is why it's important, because I do find that, you know, when I'm being interviewed by, like, NBC News and it's this guy saying that to me, I say, yeah, look at me. I am interested. And then when I say this to them, what I just said to you in a sober way, they're like, oh,
that makes
really
sense.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I never thought
right.
of it that
yeah,
way.
I never thought
so
about
I think it
that.
Is our, yeah, it's our job. I think it's just there's such a stigma around it. It's our job to change people's attitudes just through gentle conversations and not trying to change anyone's mind. Just, yeah, here's how I think about it.
Yep. Well, I always say to people, you know, death is actually the most natural thing in the world. So it's probably, you know, there are a lot of things, unnatural things we do in life, and death is not one of them. So.
Forrest! Forrest, what happened?
I got screwed. I don't know. Some vision came and said that I was going to get pardoned, and they shot me.
You were my one great love.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm dead.
What's it like?
What's it like? You know the chicken at Tresky's restaurant?
Yeah.
It's worse.
Worse than the chicken at Tresky's. Oh, well, life must go on.
Noir and Bizarre is an original WYPR production, hosted and produced by me, Katie Marquette. Until next time, thanks for listening.